Hello, hello. Welcome to the Shropshire Witches podcast. I'm Alex.
And I'm Amy.
Hello. And today, tonight, this morning, whenever you're going to be listening to this, we're talking to you about prisons and the history of prisons. So we've been very excited about covering this. And we've been discussing what we're going to kind of go into. So I'm going to give you a bit of a whirlwind whistle stop, very quick sort of outline, a bit of prisons and the kind of the history of prisons. And then Amy's going to go into more focused about specific prisons and some stories for us. And then we'll kind of talk about different things like prison hulks and various things together and just sort of chat in general. That sounds about right, I think. Amy, do you agree?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think you're on the money there.
Perfect, perfect, perfect. We always like to think we've got a kind of at least a rough plan, and then we'll sort of just see
There's no
what
plan.
happens. Yeah, there's no plan, okay? There's a bit like that's it. There's no itinerary. We don't know what's going to happen. So I suppose when you look at prisons, do you know? And actually, look, having said, so we've already gone off piste. Having said, I was going to do a sort of whistle stop tour of prisons. I'm going to ask you this first, Amy, because this is something I've been thinking about. I've been obsessed with the history of prisons. I know it's penal reform and things like that, but whenever I see penal, I think of like,
I know what you think of.
yeah, penal. Yeah, I think of penis reform, penal reform, but strong start. Yeah, I know, already giggling about penises, but I think, I'm always fascinated about prisons. And also, the kind of, as soon as you talk about prisons, I think you think of some of the big ones like Wormwood Scrubs, things like this. Also, then probably automatically, maybe Victorian prisons or possibly debtors' prisons, things like this. But I'm always intrigued as to why we think there's a fascination with prisons. So even if you're not into history, because you look at, true crime, things like this. So even if it's not the history aspect that people find interesting, other people, and myself, I'm no exception to this, are fascinated about what goes on inside prisons. Is it because, and I don't mean an us and them in a bad way, I mean, because people that are criminals that go to prison, because we never fully know, unless you work in a prison or you go to prison, you're not really going to know necessarily what goes on in there. And is it that elusiveness that's fascinating? Is it the violence that occasionally gets leaked into the press? Like, what do you think it is that has this perennial fixation with prisons that holds us all in a sort of headlock, basically a fascination? What do you think it is?
I think it's a lot of things. So I think you're right in saying it's kind of the idea of certain things getting leaked to us and certain crimes being quite sensationalized. And that happened, throughout probably from around the 1600s through certain crimes get absolutely sensationalized and they have almost a following of their own. But I think also sometimes it's where the prison is the most. Areas have a local prison. Even if it's kind of, so I live in Telford, but the local prison in the kind of Victorian times would have been Shrewsbury. They gain a reputation of their own, even in the surrounding areas. I think sometimes literally because of how domineering of a presence the buildings are. I think people who certainly working class people would have all known somebody who knew somebody who'd have ended up in one in the past. And the idea of crime in itself is awful, and particularly some of the really heinous crimes that become infamous. But also we're fascinated with them because they're a very human thing. They s literally involve humans. They involve human emotions. And I think that's part of the charm. I think when you've got a building as well that is very lingering and almost a monolith in itself, you only ponder what goes on behind those doors. They almost become, I think, a folklore of their own,
Yeah, I agree.
and there's an idea of all these awful things that must be happening, and quite often that's the case. There was still, awful things happening in prison with who were struggling, but I think it's the not knowing as much as the knowing. You know about the famous trials, you know about the famous criminals, but also what lurks beneath the depths, what happens that we don't know about. And I think for as long as there have been kind of prisons in the traditional way we would see them today, we've had that curiosity. So I think there's as many reasons why we are curious about true crime and kind of prisons as there are probably people that have ended up in there. Yeah, but I think it's just a very human thing to look at this slightly darker side of existence with curiosity.
Yeah, I think you articulate that perfectly, and it's a sort of multi-pronged thing, isn't it? Because on one hand, you're trying to fathom how these people have done things they've done, and then also morbid curiosity, you want to know more about it, depending on the crime mm-hmm. generally, but that is the human proclivity for gore. And basically in that sense, it's almost really like public executions, isn't it? It just didn't sort of fully go away, really. And architecturally, yeah, because it's funny how these things are impregnated in our mind in terms of, like, you know, look, let's look at a case in point with Wormwood Scrubs, one of the most, and we'll talk more about prisons, like as in actual famous ones shortly, but in terms of layout, because I think, wasn't it, was it Kilmaine and in Dublin jail that was used in the Italian job, but I think it was Wormwood Scrubs on the outside, wasn't it? I think that's right. If I'm wrong, If I'm wrong, someone can tweet us and, you know, be mean to us, but please don't. But
We'll cry.
Yeah, like, oh God, you've hurt my feelings. But I think those are, like, that's a good example of a kind of iconic looking prison. It's monolithic, Tower of London, case in point. Very, very old prison. And then you look at ones like Dartmoor, Pentonville. Dartmoor, and I remember once hearing about this, or reading, I can't remember, but because of the mist from the moor, it goes through the windows, and they would wake up in their cells, like, full of mist. And I was like, oh God, that's really creepy. That's really, really creepy. And the layout, you know, when you kind of have these clear sight lines, that, you know, so they can always be seen in that kind of very Victorian way. The doorways that kind of fitted the average Victorian body and now probably don't always fit kind of the taller, bigger, broader, whatever, a lot of modern bodies, particularly in prison, where a lot of blokes kind of bulk out and either through fitness or whatever it may be. And then, like, candle alcoves for reading the Bible. There's all these different things. But yeah, it's this kind of monolithic, eerie, you know, the condemned cell, all these things that are so, they're just with us, aren't they? And even things like, overcrowding or slopping out, which actually, apparently, until recently, and actually even still, there has been cases where, because of overcrowding, still prisoners that slop out, which, for those that don't know what that is basically defecating, etc., into a bucket in the morning. You'd come out and you'd slop out. And there are old prison guards that still talk about that, and they can remember the smell and things like that. And it was going on till, you know, well into the 90s and things. But there's certainly things, and it crops up in the press every so often, about prisons where this has still happened. And I think there was one in Scotland somewhere. It wasn't all that long ago. And again, largely overcrowding, funding, all these sorts of things. I suppose it's just something. Anything that isn't, that is present in everyday life in terms of people walking past Wormwood Scrubs and places like that, but something that we generally don't know about. But then it's interesting because you mentioned about people knowing someone that might have gone to prison, things like that, as is still the case. But also then I thought about debtors' prisons and things, and I'm passing from the cops here, but a lot of, you know, when we say, like, gentry, working class, things like that, we're not kind of pinning to anything. We're just kind of using examples more like historically, I think, rather than kind of
we don't think that there are certain people who are better than other people. But you are correct that people historically that we've been seen as working class, agrarian classes, the gentry, that kind of thing. So they're historical terms.
Exactly. And actually then and now, the majority of people in prison come from what you would perceive as a kind of maybe classically, typically, however you want to put it, working class background, or certainly backgrounds that have that would be, I suppose, abject poverty in terms of the way they have to live and things like that, which is a whole social strata. I mean, I won't go into that, and possibly until maybe a bit further into the, because we're not going to be a politics podcast, I know that, but it's flawed, the system, and a lot of people are let down. But I think it's interesting because when you think about debtors' prisons and things like that, of course, there was a lot of people who were very, very wealthy, and they're not, because obviously they're in a debtors' prison. But this idea that they would have, you know, had all this wealth and then ended up you know, owing money. And I think it was in the 1500s, I can't remember exactly when, it became, rather than, you used to be able to be sort of imprisoned in a debtor's prison for money that was owed to the crown, but it got into the 16th, I think mid 16th century, where you could actually then be held prisoner for money owed to a person as well. You know, I mean, I know the crown is a person, but, you know, in terms of, you know, an everyday person, if you will. So they would have, you know, kind of affected people across the board, which I think is rather interesting as well. In terms of a sort of whirlwind history, I think when you think about, so incarcerating people, it depends how you're going to look at prison. I think of them in two different ways, and perhaps I'm wrong here. I'd be interested again to know what you think, but I think of them perhaps arguably as a jail and as a prison. And I know, of course, that when you're in America, prison is jail, or penitentiary. Is that how they say it? Penitentiary? I can never say it, that word probably.
No, that's right.
Yeah. I say both words differently, but no, that's right. Either those may or may not be right. But, you know, but jail, I mean, county jail, I think is all different. But I know in the UK, generally, jail, you often refer to it mostly as prison. And jails, you might think of, rather than J-A-I-L, G-A-O-L is the kind of historic jail. And that was more sort of holding people to decide what to do, rather than necessarily holding them as the punishment, if you see what I mean. So that idea of holding people as that being the punishment is still has a long history, but was really sort of, I don't want to say in its infancy in medieval times, because that's not quite right, but, you know, in the 16th and 17th century, things like that, there were, which is obviously later on again, there were more kind of public ways of shaming people and things like that, like the ducking, whipping, branding stocks, things like this. Prior to that, as I was mentioning, in the medieval times, there were things that basically, they held people as the punishment and perhaps as cruelty, and even going as far-fetched as things like oubliettes, so they drop them in the little kind of almost like a, I want to say a snug, but that's the wrong word for an oubliette, but like a space, like a almost that you would just be left in, forgotten about, obviously, hence the name. And there were things in medieval times where they did exist in terms of that being the punishment, but it's generally something that's going more in the kind of, you know, typically as we would think of it, 17th, 18th, 19th century, which would be more a system that we're starting to recognise.
Yeah, more familiar, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that said, you know, you've got a place like Newgate, which I'll talk about again a bit later on. I mean, I've been saying that about everything. We're going to talk about some sort of stuff later on. So we'll get a heap of later on. But, you know, looking at some of these prisons going into well into the 18th century that were described as disorganised, barbaric and filthy, you know, this idea came a little bit later on when you went into the 1790s, the Penitentiary Act, that jails would be built for one inmate per cell and operate on a silent system with a continuous labour. And that, again, then start bringing in things like the treadwheel, things like that, and this idea of wearing the sacks over their face so they wouldn't recognise each other. And as you go into the sort of the 19th century, which, again, is the kind of, like the watershed of punishment, things changed then in terms of, like, you know, capital punishment for serious offences, things like this. All these things started to change. And then even the idea of towards debtors' prisons, which I'll talk more about. But as we go into the 19th century, you get Millbank in 1816, and that had 860 prisoners in separate cells.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a lot. There's a hell of a lot more people in prison today. 1842 Pentonville, which still exists, and that was designed to hold 520. I'm going to look up afterwards, and I should have done before, how many people it holds today. I'll wager it's a lot more than that. But the cells measured 13 feet long, 7 feet wide, and 9 feet high. So it's, it was intense, I think, because these sort of prisons, they had existed, like Shepton Mallet, ones like this, that were older. And then I know that Dartmoor is one that's one of the oldest. That's an 18th century prison still in existence. But in the 19th century, they started to come up thicker and faster. And the layout, the cells, things started to change. And the Quakers and whatnot, evangelicals got involved trying to, you know, encourage prison reform. And then there's a Prison Act, of course, in 1898. So I'm moving forward really rather quickly. And then we go into the 20th century and you have the suffragettes and things. And I want to talk about the suffragettes separately. But you also get the probation order, which was the 1907 probation service, which was the first community service sentence, which we sort of think about now. And then it was actually one thing I did think was interesting. In 1948, they abolished the penal servitude, hard labour and flogging. So I'm not saying that it had happened necessarily up until 1948, but it took until then to ban that. So we start talking about things like then, you know, you're going way forward into like the death penalty and things that we actually will talk about. But when things started to get altered, but, you know, for example, in 1868, when execution ceased to be ceased to be done in public. I'm trying to think of the way to kind of describe that. But, you know, in many ways, you look at this idea of the 19th century being, you know, Elizabeth Fry and being pioneers of change, but also the Vagrancy Act of 1824 was a piece of legislation that made it a criminal offence to be homeless, basically to sleep rough or beg in England or Wales. So, and it was passed because of the increased number of people that were experiencing homelessness. So they were like, do you know what? I know what we're going to do about this.
Criminalize you.
Yeah. I think we should make it illegal. And you're like, interesting, interesting response to those in genuine need. But, you know, hey,
they've
changed so little in 200 years. But there you go. So as I say, it's kind of like, you know, it's rather a fast moving timeline. But when you look at things like the clink, maybe that's very, very famous, which it goes way back, sort of, I think it's the 1100s, 1200s, isn't it? But the clink, it's a name that they that kind of stuck to it in the 14th century. It's got different reasons as to where that derived from, whether it was the blacksmith hammer of the irons and things on the prisoners. But also there's a Flemish word apparently that clink means latch. So who knows? But it's still a phrase that we use in terms of, you know, the nick today, the clink doing porridge, Her Majesty or His Majesty's pleasure now, or dare doing bird, stretch doing time, the big house, whatever you want to call it. The clink is probably one of the longest standing. And I would say if you say someone's in the clink, you instantly know what they mean, don't you? So
yeah.
There's old prisons like that. And I mean, these were bleak, bleak places. And Newgate was a really good example of that. And in fact, such was the stench coming from Newgate that some of the shops in summer would close that were near there. And the Old Bailey actually is on the site of Newgate now, isn't it? I'm sure it's the Old Bailey.
I think so.
I'm sure it is. And obviously then, you know, within conditions and things you had, typhus, jail fever, things like that, same thing. So, you know, there is a timeline, but also it's a kind of, it gets kind of a bit messy because, you know, you can't really say that, nobody kind of thought of prisons as prisons until kind of the 1700s, because it's not true. It's not really like the police, where it kind of started in the 19th century and there was things and it kind of had a more clear timeline. This was a slightly different thing because there were prisons, in inverted commas, in the sort of 14, 1500s. But I would say more as we recognise them going into kind of the, you know, as I say, the 17, 1800s generally. And then they coexisted with debtors' prisons, which, you know, although kind of by the start of the 20th century had gone, in the 19th century were, you know, in all literature and things like that, and were so familiar to people, they would know what the Marshalsea was. They would know, and Newgate, obviously famously a debtors' prison, they would know all these things, all these references. So I want to give you a timeline, but also at the same time, there's not really a strict timeline one could follow. I don't know how helpful that is.
Yeah, no, I completely see what you mean. It's a continuity whilst still having those different changes, which I think I've just as vague as they could be, but there is a continuity there of there being some sort of space where people who have done a perceived wrong are punished, but it's not always the same punishment, and it's not always the same conditions or the same kind of location kind of thing.
Exactly, because things like, you know, like the poor law, all these things that kind of change things. And in the 18th century, you had something that was a kind of the era of the the Bloody Code, which was this kind of growing opposition to the death penalty, and how attitudes were starting to change towards that, which in itself is also kind of absolutely fascinating. And by the late kind of 1700s, there were over 220 crimes that could attract the death penalty, which is just insane, isn't it?
So insane, isn't it? Yeah.
And so, like, obviously, so for the, you know, the upper classes, prior to that, it was beheading for treason. Some could be hung, drawn and quartered, of course. But, you know, these kind of ideas of things that were punishable by death could be, so, for example, the late 18th century in our legal system referred to as the Bloody Code. Some of the 220 crimes in Britain that could attract the death sentence would include, brace yourself now, cutting down a tree. I mean, in a way, I'm not pro-death penalty at all, but cutting down a tree is a shit move. It really irritates me, okay? Like, I'm like, can you just... Yeah, just not. Okay. I know if the tree is fungus and things like that, that's... But when people do it for no reason other than their own gain, and do not get me started on the Sycamore Gap chap, like, honestly.
No.
Anyway, so you could do that. Stealing from a rabbit warren. Again, like, I'm not being funny, Amy. If you and I were kind of pro-death penalty, these are things we wouldn't like.
Take
a rabbit from a warren, don't go to their... Don't take them, but don't go to their place of, you know, of safety and take them. And then weirdly and really frankly very inappropriately being out at night with a blackened face, which they give no reason why one would be doing that, but that was punishable by death. I don't know if he was ever killed, like, for doing that or weird,
like, because potentially if you were a minor walking home at night, that could put you in trouble.
Grave, yeah. I must be stipulations as to what, you know, if it was just clear that you'd been in the mine or something, I'm sure. Well, who knows?
A swag bag on your back and like...
like a kind of like, they sort of like, God, with the striped jumper.
Yeah.
Come on, mate. Be a little bit discreet, whatever it is that you're doing. But this kind of idea of, I suppose, of like behaving yourself and gruesome methods to... As a sort of warning, were ever present. And in many ways, prisons and things, like you say, because they were jails that were really holding places until something probably quite horrible happened to you, and or maybe if you were fortunate enough, you were released. Although a lot of people, because of deprivation, were recidivists. But the 18th and 19th century, we see this kind of idea of things sort of changing in a way, and people started to look more at the death penalty and looking at what people were actually being killed for. And Elizabeth Fry, of course, a Quaker, there they are, the Quakers, that, you know, they're out to do what all the Quakers do. But
get that on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
On a t-shirt.
Get it on there right now. And she, although actually interesting, she never openly campaigned for the complete abolition of the death penalty. She was a great advocate for reform and change, particularly with female prisoners at Newgate. Mm-hmm. And she was very influential in passing reforms, as we know. So, yeah, this kind of timeline that has taken a bit of a weaving journey for anyone who's probably thinking, what? You know, things like the 19th century. So you could no longer be killed for some wider crimes like pickpocketing, forgery and rape. I mean, quite interesting crimes to be sort of put together there. I mean, they seem to have gone up slightly in severity by the time you get to the end of the crimes. Okay, that escalated quickly. By 1861, the number of capital crimes had been reduced to, I think it was about five, where you could actually be killed. And it was murder, treason, espionage, and, piracy with violence, which I think is fascinating. And the other one was arson in royal dockyards. So you kind of, you're like, okay, I'm not pro death penalty at all, but you're like, murder, treason. You're like, is that, because that's still, if you kill, that's, yeah. Surely that would still be grouped with murder, but, you know, if they're royal, I suppose. But espionage, arson in royal dockyards, the royals again, covering that. And piracy with violence. But like I say, the public executions banned in 1868, the abolition of beheading and quartering, which, do you know when that was stopped? And I'm not saying it happened as recently as then, but do you know what date when that was finally banned?
No idea, but it's probably going to shock me because I'd like to say it was like medieval, but it's not, is it?
2008. No, I'm joking. No. Tomorrow. 1870.
Oh wow, yeah, so
Oh, nice and recent. Good. Reassuring.
I love how with recent is like 1800s. We're both on that side of the
Yeah.
page where
Spectrum, aren't we?
like
Like, recent.
I'm an early medievalist and recent for me is like 1790. I remember it well. Or
Yeah.
maybe we're both vampires.
Yeah, I think so. I think we've just, yeah, that's exactly it. I'm like, oh yeah, 1870, but a mere pup. And the age at which somebody could be executed was raised from 16 to 18 in a rather comforting 1933. So you're like,
Oh, good,
oh,
good.
guys. And then, you go into the Second World War and things, and things, started to, there was distraction with obviously the war, but some reforms and things were shelved. And then by the 1950s, there was a murder act that was reduced, that murder could be punishable by death. And in 1965, the penalty for murder in Britain was suspended for 5 years. And in 1969, it was made permanent. But this is interesting again, because this is in both our lifetimes. Well, the last 600 years have been in our lifetime, technically. But yeah, it was, da, 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 that was the worst drum roll ever, 1998. That the death
Oh.
penalty in Britain was finally abolished for all crimes.
Wow, I did
Yeah.
not know that.
And the last execution was in 1964. So yeah, it took quite a long time after that. To be kind of to have something done about it. So there obviously are still many countries that have the death penalty. And since the early 2000s, the 10th of October has been observed as the World Day Against Death Penalty. So it's fascinating, but I mean, it's a bit of a whirlwind timeline of events. And within that, we'll go into more specific prisons, we'll go into prison hulks and things like that. But it is interesting to me, the kind of the variety of things. And I want to say that the change, yeah, things did start to move over a couple of 100 years. But I mean, we're still overcrowded. There's still prisons slopping out. We're still not in a great place. The cells that 100 or so years ago housed one now housed two. And that is because obviously the population has increased and things like this, but we haven't really met the demand for that. And I think that prisoners then, just as kind of now, nobody really knows what to do with them. And you have it in the press, and people are like, oh, they've all got TVs, they've all got this, they've all got that. Like, I don't really think any of them are living in the lap of luxury. I think a lot of them are living in
No.
fear and, are worried about getting stabbed, attacked, and gang initiations, all these things that are vile. I don't think there's anyone in there that's kind of on easy street, and a lot of them are there because of huge social problems, child trauma, things like this. I'm not excusing it at all. That's not what I'm doing.
No.
I just think I think things like the Daily Mail don't always help when they're like,
No.
I don't know, whatever, kind of inaccurate, maybe crime statistics, or that all young offenders are doing this or doing that, or have got TVs and pool tables and things like this. And you're like, yeah, okay, well, I'm not quite sure that's a representation of what prisons actually like. And I suppose in many ways, I'm sure they'd like them sitting in a little dungeon somewhere, just like when they started building the Tower of London. But, I think over a kind of maybe 900 to 1,000 year history of some sort of building as a prison in the UK, things are still pretty bleak, and a lot of prisons are still infested with rodents and things like that. So yeah, it's not great. Oh, and also I did find out in my notes, which I was completely wrong, it was in fact 1352 that the imprisonment for debt was to anyone owned. So I was quite a few
Oh.
centuries out. It wasn't the 1500, but it was 1352. I got it down and I was thinking, I'm sure it's the 1500s, but I got it wrong. So yeah, forgive me, but there we go. And I think, as I say, even going into kind of 1550s, they had a House of Corrections. Things have been, for the last sort of 500, 600 years, kind of moving into prisons, like I say, as we would know them. But I don't think we're anywhere close to where maybe we should be in reform and things like that. I think we're all still pretty, even since the 1823 Jails Act to regulate imprisonment in local prisons, things like this, uniformity, where, there's still areas where there's huge poverty in prisons, depending where they are. And yeah, it's a very problematic thing, isn't it?
And I think that's through when during my research for this episode, that's something that I was very aware of that is something that's echoing through time. Particularly when you look at some communities kind of within Shropshire, prison or the fear of prison or the acknowledgement of prison was a very, very real thing. And I think we talked about this a little bit when we looked at workhouses. The other option was prison often for a lot of people. And I'm kind of from the Telford area, and a lot of my family originate in the Ironbridge Gorge. In the Ironbridge Gorge, I'm not going to talk too much about it because I want to do, we're going not to announce a special, but there's a future special about the poacher men of the Coracle men and the poacher men of the Ironbridge. But a lot of those men spent more time in prison than they actually spent out of prison. And there's a wonderful man who I can't wait to tell more about called Tommy Rogers, and he's the grandfather of Eusty Rogers, who was the last Coracle man. And he spent, I think it was about 20 years in prison of his if, when you added up all of his sentences. And there's a lovely anecdote about the Ironbridge police station, which had a little kind of holding cell jail there. And Tommy actually helped build the prison, the jail and the Ironbridge police station. And then I think it was about a week or two after, he was actually in there because he'd been caught poaching.
Oh my
So,
God, okay.
yeah, and he helped actually build it. So for a lot of people, the crime was a necessity. Poaching was one that was really, really frowned upon and looked down upon, particularly in Shropshire, as I am in other agrarian or semi-rural areas would have. But it was a necessity, so you would do these things and end up going to prison. And in the 1800s, poaching had a sentence of up to 7 years, if you were caught kind of poaching. So it was something that was a part of daily life, and it was a fear that was probably part of daily life for a lot of people as well. I think that's where, because it's so within daily life, it gains that folklore of its own, and the imagination runs wild a little bit. So I think that's only one example of it, but it would be very hard to escape the influence of these buildings. And I can imagine when if you live near some of the bigger ones in London and elsewhere, it would have been a very, very real presence for you.
Yeah, well, because they kind of came up not out of nowhere, but like, so Pentonville was 1842, but this idea of kind of 1865, the new Prison Act, so that got rid of that kind of different differentiating whatever between jails and houses of kind of correction, and that uniformed idea of a prison came into being. So with these kind of prisons excuse me, kind of coming up in this kind of Dartmoor, things like this, these kind of very monolithic prisons were still kind of largely end of the 18th century, but some of them right kind of going into the mid 19th. And so it was for some people for quite a long time still this kind of quite eerie, very, I suppose, like the workhouse would have been for some people, this kind of thing that was just there to show you, like, in a way it's the architectural head on a pike, isn't it, really,
Yes,
saying
oh,
behave
definitely.
yourself because otherwise you're going to go in here and nobody knows what goes on in here. I mean, look, the abuse and things that went on, but even kind of looking at it wasn't until about 1878 that local prisons in England and Wales were nationalized. So until then it was kind of more of a, not like a parish, well, yeah, I suppose it was in a way, but there became like a sort of uniformed kind of, I suppose, penis system, if you will. You can't send that to a penis system. That's so childish. We're better than that. Well, you are
We're not.
anyway. But yeah,
We're not.
we're not. I'm sorry, we're not. And thank you for the loyalty thus far, guys. We're not better than saying penis system. But you know us, we will laugh at a cock if we can. So, in 1890s, there was kind of the Gladstone Committee and prisoners then. The Home Office, you're looking at this kind of a new era of imprisonment. So they were looking more into kind of non-custodial sentences and things like that. But again, for like the best part of 100, 200 years, maybe, these kind of buildings that were cropping up were intimidating. And you'd gone from a little kind of parish somewhere that maybe, a bawdy woman went in shouting profanities and, eliciting whatever was kind of thrown in, to these kind of places that you were leaving your parish or whatever to go to places like this. So it must have been immensely intimidating for a lot of people, but also particularly if you were going from smaller towns and things, just as I suppose it would be today, to go to these great big places where really, whatever your crime might be, some people would be low level mixed with people that were really hardened recidivist criminals. It's a very different world. And I suppose that's, you know, for many people, part of the punishment. And maybe some people feel that that's right. But it still exists today, this idea of, you know, Cat B, Cat A, Cat things, you know, Cat C, open prisons, you know. But a lot of people still go to the kind of the bad prison straight away. And then, you know, when time kind of permits things, then you kind of end up moving and depends on good behaviour, things like that. But there are people grouped in these terrifying places that maybe in some cases might not always need to be somewhere quite so, you know, terrifying. And I think that is still the case going on from what you're saying there, is like people, you know, through necessity a lot of the time are committing crimes and ending up in these, what was at that point, modern prisons, must have been so intense and terrifying, one would assume.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I think they are still, and they always have been, that instrument of fear. And I think that's part of the, I don't want to say allure as well, but fascination maybe, is that we are so scared of what goes on there that perhaps that's why we're drawn to looking at them. And I think when you look into...
Yeah, it's a perversity, isn't it? It's a it is a type of, you know, because we're like, oh, what goes on? That's horrible. That's really creepy. We're completely intoxicated by it. But yeah, carry on.
That when we look into some of the kind of the histories of the buildings, particularly when you do like a deep dive into one, those fears are very justified, and then that interest, which then justifies the interest. So I think they're also really important buildings to look at and to study and you know, learn about, because it's just as much part of those less spoken about histories as the workhouse or other things. So I think they do have a real cultural significance and importance, because it's a history that's not always told, and not always told compassionately.
Yeah, that's interesting. And the thing is, like, it's so interesting about the workhouses, because these buildings, so as I said before, the first Penitentiary Act was 1779, but within sort of 1780s, 1790s, about 60 prisons were either substantially kind of altered, restored, whatever, rebuilt, were being built. So, and like the workhouses, these kind of things, admin, whatever, it's going on sort of almost on a quieter scale. And then suddenly it was like, bosh, you know, every kind of county would have, you know, a handful of workhouses. And suddenly these prisons were like, you know, London would have more prisons than it had in however many centuries, you know. So things like Newgate, which interestingly enough wasn't demolished until right at the start of the 1900s, were kind of almost like usurped by these now penitentiary kind of great big places. It's so interesting. And I think even, see, like in the 1770s, there was a state of prisons in England and Wales. And that at that point was exposing how grotesque the conditions were in jails and houses of correction. And there's a chap actually who wrote about it in Ireland, and horrendous. But his name is like the most... every so often there's an episode where we get someone's name who absolutely kind of epitomizes the era. And this guy, oh, wait for it, Jeremiah Fitzpatrick. Like, that guy is like, you know, and he has the most 18th century name ever. but yeah, it's interesting how for, you know, a few hundred years, that they were...
people in the medieval period, they loved having a pint, they loved having a laugh, and they loved dick jokes. Yeah. People in the Victorian times loved dick jokes, and we still do. We're not that different. Our core humanity is still the same. We love, we laugh, we fear, we make mistakes, just like people did in the past.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we can look at the past and look at sometimes the barbarity of the past and look down on it, but in many ways, we're no different. And in many ways, there is some version of that still going on, happening. So I agree with you there. And I think it's a folly to look at those who came before us as less than us, because they're no different. They've just live in different circumstances. But even then, their circumstances mirror our own in some ways.
Yeah, and I think it's like we're saying, like this kind of now we just hear or read stories and watch things on Netflix about executions, things like that. But you know, it was, you know, apart from people kind of standing in windows and things and letting out window space for people to have a look, because they had a really good view of the gallows or whatever it may be. But you know, this idea of people like, in the 1780s, the government was kind of breathing down magistrates' necks, really, to keep executions inside because they were trying to stop this sort of baying mob mentality. But instead, they would just do it on the roof of the prison so people could still see what was going on because, you know, give the audience what they're asking for. And look, I think, of course, there's always this historical thing of going, it was all done as a warning and deterrent. And you're like, yes, but also bollocks. People wanted to see shit like that. They just did. And it's not my sentiment. And just as it appalled people at the time, there are still people that are pro-death penalty. So, you know, you're absolutely right. This separation isn't, I mean, maybe they were more bloodthirsty because we've been sanitized and we're generally, for the most part, more moderate, but still there are people with, you know, who watch horrible films with like absurd violence and things like that and be like, you know, yeah, they're not going to go and perpetrate those crimes themselves, but they can still stomach seeing it on television. And that's kind of whitewashed in a bit of a way, like you're separated, but you know, public executions going on until 1868 and then it became illegal. But, you know, even like hanging and stuff, so Newgate Prison, 1783, this new drop was this idea of kind of, you know, getting rid of like the gallows tree, things like that, and hoisting people up as they did, which was horrible. Like, you know, the Tyburn jig, because the body took so long to die. But the 1780s, they had a new drop, which was kind of basically a way where you would drop, but it would take longer. You would suffocate. And then William Marwood, the executioner, developed the long drop, which was a way which, you know, was developed again. This is in the 1870s onwards. That would snap the neck, basically. So in theory, was quicker. It was not always the case because you could misjudge it, and then you can go into like Albert Pierpoint and things, and we'll talk about him again a bit later on. But I will always be convinced that there is this idea of the kind of the death penalty thing. It is in no small part long-standing because it was like a feast day for people. Do you know what I mean? And they would get some of the criminals, you know, if they were criminals that were beloved, they would get them a bit drunk on the way, and others would get booed or pelted. And there were those that historically had died on the way to being executed, you know, and there were also ones where friends would kind of dangle off their legs trying to quicken the death. And, you know, it just became this whole sort of thing. And I think had people not been so intensely interested in it, would it have lasted with the same... I don't know. Would they have made like some of the deaths and things such a statement? Don't know. Yeah. I think it's... I don't know.
Theatre, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's almost a theatre in its own. Yeah,
of course. Of course it is. And it's, you know, then you're going into like castration, all these things they did and they hung drawn quartered. And, you know, and I know obviously the symbolism behind that, but also public executions. I mean, to go on for that long has to be in no small part because people were like, let's go and watch someone die. And you're like,
I like some good hanging.
Yeah, I loves a good hanging, mate. And you're like, lovely. Do you mind if I just watch The Antiques Roadshow instead? But yeah, right. So shall we go into, because I have waffled on for ages, should we go into specific prisons? Because I'll talk about like Holloway and stuff afterwards, but I'm dying to hear from you. You're going to talk about specific prisons and I've just banged on for long enough. I want to hear what you're going to tell me and I'm dying to know.
Never bang on, but I'm happy to oblige. So listeners, so I think I'd like to touch on briefly when you mentioned kind of how prisons were at one point, or jails at one point, were held until particular punishments were enacted on you. And some kind of really quite famous examples of kind of the ducking stool and various other types of punishment in Shropshire, kind of centred around Shrewsbury and various other places. So Shrewsbury was, for people who don't know, was all of Shropshire and kind of counties surrounding it are historically an area of the Welsh Marches. And that meant that they were kind of a centre of power. They were really the areas that protected England from encroaching Welsh or rebellions throughout quite a lot of the medieval period, really. And in some regards, the Marcher Lords, they were certainly incredibly powerful, but their power in many ways became independent. They still had to do what the king said, but ultimately within their own realm, they could do what they wanted. And you get certain Marcher Lords like Roger de Montgomery, who was known to rule the area with an iron fist. He was particularly... trigger happy with his punishments, and he His tomb is actually in Shrewsbury Abbey, if for people
Oh.
who are interested. When I went, there was kind of lots of stuff built on it. He was being used as a kind of table, which is quite for him because
Good for you.
he wasn't a very nice man. But Shrewsbury probably is, when we look at punishment, Shrewsbury Jail was notorious during the medieval period for being quite brutal. And that kind of reputation continues throughout, and I'll talk a lot more about Shrewsbury Jail. Really, it'll be Shrewsbury Prison, the focus of my, what I'm going to say. But Shrewsbury had a ducking stool, a famous ducking stool. So if you know the area, obviously you do, but listeners, the Market Hall in Shrewsbury, the old Market Hall, near the Music Hall. So that we, yeah, we're making these connections.
Oh yeah, previous app, listen in. Yeah, keep going.
At one point, there was supposedly a pool, or in some records, it refers to it as a bog rather nicely. Love a bog.
Not a loo. Yeah.
And that was called Bishop's Pool. And it was meant to be the site of the ducking stool. And it said that Shrewsbury used the ducking stool most prominently for nagging wives and dishonest raiders. I
Bloody
hate it.
hell. I love that grouping. That's so weird.
Yeah, and the ducking stool, it's various records, but it's potentially was in Shrewsbury as early as 1292, so it has a long, long history. And apparently at one point, kind of you're looking into your kind of 16, 1700s time, the husband had to foot the bill, but it was 1 farthing for each immersion. So I suppose if
God,
you
I
were
bet he
really,
bloody loved it as well. Yeah.
I bet he did. If you were really annoyed with your wife, I suppose you could pay a few extra farthings and
Yeah,
watch her
don't
kind
need the
of,
change. You keep going. Yeah.
yeah. And there are, rather interestingly, there are other areas in Shropshire that have ducking stools or have had ducking stools. We don't use them now, listeners. We're beyond that now.
Just
just,
about.
but in Middle, which is quite famous for Gough's History of the Middle, which kind of is a history book that tells us about life during the kind of advent of the 1700s in the town of Middle. In the church, they have the remains of a ducking stool. It's just in the corner as you go in. And it was really bizarre when me and my partner visited recently, and it had a horrible atmosphere. The church itself was fine, but the ducking stool just felt, it just felt like it had been used to harm people, you know. But if you are interested in seeing a ducking stool, you can visit the church in Middle and see part of one. You get various other things, so the scold's bridle and things mentioned in Shrewsbury, but the stocks, I love this. It's an anecdote, if you know, it's not very big, but the stocks were last used in Shrewsbury as late as 1850,
Oh my God.
which is quite late really, but
Classic
it was
Shropshire.
for a policeman who was caught being drunk and disorderly on duty. Legend.
Nice. Yeah.
And he was so loved, and the community found it so funny that they had a collection for him, supposedly. Now, I don't, this is a little bit probably more folklore, but supposedly they had a collection for him. And as soon as he got out of the stocks, he took the money and went to the pub.
Another one bites
Yeah.
the
So,
dust. Good
Shrewsbury,
for him.
I know, you just legend,
Yeah.
king behavior. So Shrewsbury has always really had a reputation for kind of punishment. And as we'll see when I get onto Shrewsbury in a little bit more detail, it's definitely warranted. But I just want to mention Castle Lodge in Ludlow.
Oh yeah, please, because I know nothing, like same as Shrewsbury Prison. I know where they are, but I know nothing about them. This is
Oh,
fascinating.
it's a lovely building. Timber framed, kind of beautiful building, and parts of the building kind of date from around the 13th century, but it's had many lifetimes. So part of it's kind of Elizabethan, part of it's Tudor. And it had lots of different jobs. It's been, and now I think it's going to be a boutique hotel, or it's been developed into one. But
How
as
is
you do,
it? Because it went for sale a few years ago, didn't I? I remember it coming up, and it because it had been a private home and a bit of a museum, but obviously someone bought it a few years ago. That's interesting. Okay, cool.
But at one point during the 1500s, it was a notorious And it was said to be such a place of punishment as common people called it hell, which I just think so primitive. It's just, you know, can only imagine what went on in the walls there. But then eventually by 1570, it became the official residence for officials who were serving on the Council of the Marches. So it went from being a prison. I think it still had the cells to some capacity through to about the 1600s. But it was became an official building. At one point, it's rumoured that Catherine of Aragon stayed there. Certainly, she has connections to
Ludlow. She went to the castle. Yeah, that's really interesting. I didn't know that. Okay, that's very interesting.
But it's believed to be haunted, as you can imagine, with being a building with such a history and such a prolonged kind of history of punishment and being a literal prison. But lots of people have reported kind of ominous presences, ill feeling, and there has been reporting of a apparition of a former sergeant who was said to be notoriously quite brutal. And he's meant to wander freely in Tudor attire with the rattling of keys following him, which I just think is straight out of, you know, it's just so provocative, isn't it?
Yeah, well, he's massively, like, he's swinging it about, isn't he?
That's he's cork kind of
thing. He's like, he's a walking copies. That guy's like,
So Castle Lodge didn't spend very long of its lifetime as a prison, but it's certainly still... It harkens back to that, and the reports of the apparitions and the ghosts, they all come back to that time where it was a place of jurisdiction and punishment and a prison or a jail. But I want to go back to Shrewsbury and talk about Shrewsbury Prison.
Yeah.
Because Shrewsbury Prison has a very long history as well. There was an earlier medieval jail that was kind of linked to the... castle, and then there was a Georgian jail, and then there was the one that we are to recognize now if we was to kind of look at the building. And the Georgian jail, or some the remains of the Georgian jail, are said to be underneath the modern building now.
Okay.
So a new jail for Shropshire was kind of first being spoken about by kind of like the 1760s, 1770s. And it was actually built by Thomas Telford, who built a lot of the area.
So I have a quick question. Sorry, is that interrupting?
Yeah,
where did they go before that?
So very, very early period, it was kind of the castle, because the castle had its own kind of dungeons and things.
Oh, it was fairly typical for that kind of era. Okay. Yeah.
And then there was a rudimentary kind of prison on the site or nearby. I think it's adjacent up until the Georgian period, and then the Georgian period was when it really became what we would recognize now as a prison.
Okay.
And then they rebuilt it by between 1787 and 1793, with Thomas Telford being involved. And it opened officially in 1793, and it had 204 cells. There was 179 for males, 25 for females, and a debtor's ward and an infirmary, which is quite interesting. Some of the earlier prisons, that wasn't, it was kind of, they would repurpose it in Shropshire rather than actually build a specific infirmary. The governor's house was kind of a two-story building that was just inside the main gate, which I think quite interesting that the governor of the prison would have literally lived within the prison walls.
That's extraordinary. We didn't talk about that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. So he would have been, and his family, if he had a family, would have been ever present in the building, which would have been equal parts kind of, I suppose, terrifying for him at times, but also quite useful, because I suppose it cuts down your commute.
It's like a hierarchical. That's such a bit like, I suppose, like workhouses and debtors' prisons did the same thing, but that's so weird. Yeah.
Yeah. And, that later, when after the kind of death penalty became something you couldn't do publicly, that was the room that people were put to death in.
Oh, God.
It was relatively kind of, for the time, seen as quite a well-developed prison, particularly because it had been influenced by some of the work of John Howard. He wasn't involved with the building. But those who were involved with the building of the prison were influenced by the prison reformer John Howard, and was known locally as the Dana. I think I'm pronouncing that right.
The Dana, yeah.
Dana, yeah.
I
In
was going to
Telford,
ask
we...
that. What do you, I was just about to ask. I thought, right, okay, because I'm interested as a kind of Ironbridge, Telford, Coalbrookdale kind of girl.
Yeah.
So we would say the Dana in Shrewsbury, but again, it's like Shrewsbury, Shrewsbury, isn't it? I'm sure, like, do you know,
Yeah.
I say the Dana, and I bet there's loads of people from Shrewsbury that probably say, she's saying it the posher way, it's the Dana. So I think, I'm going to speak for the people of Shrewsbury. I'm saying some of us have called it the Dana. I've always said the Dana. What would you guys call it? And is the Dana kind of universal through Shropshire, or is that very much the Shrewsbury name, and outside of Shrewsbury, they don't generally call it the Dana? I'm really intrigued to know. If anyone's going to know, you'll know.
Yeah, so I've always heard of it as the Dana.
Okay. I'm
Because
doing the posho way, aren't I? That's what's happening. I'm saying the Dana. Okay, yeah.
And I've, like, thinking back to people who've mentioned Shrewsbury Prison, I've never heard it, them go, oh, Shrewsbury Prison, it's the Dana.
Yeah.
Oh, Jimmy's son, Bobby, went to the Dana. They're not, you know, real people, but...
Like you
you
say
know,
the name straight out, call the midwife.
yeah, if you, you know, if you, or if you carry on behaving like that, you'll end up in the Dana, that kind of thing. So
Yeah.
it's either, it's the same as Shrewsbury, Shrewsbury and Shrewsbury,
Yeah.
like the shoe.
Yeah, I love that though. I suddenly thought, I was like, the Dana, and I suddenly thought, shit, actually, I'm sure I've heard it called the Dana, and I bet there's people listening going, don't be pompous, it's the Dana. I've always said the Dana, but that does not mean anything.
No, well, given it, I think given it that name, it's named after Edmund, I think his name's Edmund Dana,
Oh, okay, that's
he
why.
was,
That's interesting.
yeah, and he's a local reverend. I don't really know his link to the building because it didn't look like he was like directly involved. He might have been, you know, like a chaplain at some point, but it's
Yeah.
named after that.
Maybe he gave some money then or something as well. But
Yeah.
okay.
So I'm on a postcard about that one.
Yeah.
But so the original Georgian building was known as the Dana, and then the next building
Oh.
that was built later got kind of referred to it as well. So the prison, whatever prison was in Shrewsbury, was referred to as that.
That's really interesting. Is that because you know how the street's called the Dana? I keep digressing, but I just think it's
Yeah,
really.
no, it's cool.
That a bit like Strangeways, where it's actually HMP Manchester, but
Yeah.
everyone calls it Strangeways because isn't that the part of where it is Strangeways, and everyone calls it Strangeways. Is that a bit like the is, I know it's after that, but you know, there's the street called the Dana as well, but it's the prison
Yeah.
obviously came first after that chap. It wasn't like he had a part of the town named after him, like that street, and then they just
No, not that I know
no.
of. Yeah, I think it is very
Okay.
much the association with the prison.
Street followed suit, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because the prison itself has a reputation for its punishment. There was, for a relatively small prison between 1795 and 1961, there was 71 men and two women hanged there in its entire history. So I suppose
Quite
if
a
you
lot
didn't,
still, though, isn't it? But yeah.
yeah, it's a lot. It's one of those where it's not competing with your big ones like Broadmoor and Strangeways and things, but it's certainly a lot for Shropshire, I think. And it's interesting because that reputation precedes it. When I was having a look in the newspaper archives for stories and things about it was known for its deaths, it was known for its executions, and it really gained this reputation of being a place where if you ended up in there, you could not come back out. And in reality, most of the people who did end up in there weren't put to death because they came out, you know, but there was still that reputation, and I think that feeds into their infamy, these buildings. If we look at the actual conditions of the buildings, relatively in the early days, it was seen as relatively fair. It was seen as kind of, I mean, it's not, you know, a five-star hotel or anything, but it wasn't as bad as some of the others. And they'd purposely been influenced by some of the reform and the prison reformers to create it. By certainly when I looked through the newspaper archives from about the 1870s through to about 1945, 1950, the situation in there and kind of the conditions in there are dire. And there's lots of newspaper reports talking about the health of the prisoners, the in which the prisoners are treated, the kind of the conditions of the building. So it's not continued to be in this place of reform kind of thing. The first executions, I want to talk a little bit about the executions kind
Yeah,
of in
please do.
Building, and then I'll talk about some kind of famous or semi-famous faces that have graced the Danner in the
Yes,
past.
please.
So the first execution in the new jail, that took place on the 15th of August 1795, and rather kind of Englishly named John Smith. He was 25 and he was hanged for stealing 10 cotton handkerchiefs in the shop of a man called John Minor in Whitchurch of that year. And then there was Edward Quilt for theft and John Hill for being at large in the kingdom, which is an
What does
X.
that mean? He was at large in the kingdom again. Oh, God.
A wonderful, wonderful phrase that's used for when you've returned from transportation.
Oh, okay. I was about to say that's a merch phrase, but maybe it's a bit. Maybe
So,
that's not so sensitive.
yeah, so John Hill
Of
basically
course,
was
that makes sense.
transported.
Yeah, when you think about it, sorry, I'm just realizing that actually is a phrase that makes sense when you realize what it means. Carry on. That's really interesting, though. Yeah, okay.
So he was at large because he was transported and then he went, ha, joke's on you, and came back,
Oh, God.
essentially.
Fascinating.
And then there's lots of others. There's Thomas Micklewick, Thomas Micklewright, even, which is still a very Dickensian name.
Yeah, because there's a hill by me called Mucklewick, sorry, so I got excited then, but okay, yeah.
He was hanged in 1797 for cattle stealing. And then there was Adam Humphreys the following year for arson. Some of the other early kind of situations as well, there's quite a few theft going on where people were hanged for, where is it? Yes, so Daniel Bedsmore in 3rd of the 8th, 1800, so New Year, New Me, he was hung for theft.
You mean? What's that?
And we're not laughing at poor Daniel.
No, we're not. Sorry, yeah, I'm a bit behind.
It's,
Like, yeah.
and Thomas Nutts also, he got hung for sheep theft. So it's crazy to think. It goes back to that idea that you were talking about of there being so many crimes you could be put to death for. You don't steal sheep in theory for a laugh. You're not like, oh, lol, I'm going to go and, kill that sheep. You're doing it for very pertinent socioeconomic reasons. You
Yeah.
are either poor, you're, there's many reasons, but it's usually poverty when you're doing something like that. And these
Yeah.
men ended up being put to death for that, really. There's lots of others as well. There's some really quite terrible cases where someone was battered to death in 1812
Oh my
a
God.
woodworking tool similar to a pickaxe, and that was a man called John Griffiths who was put to death at Shrewsbury for doing that. And that was a crime that happened in my neck of the woods near Ketley, which is kind of near Wellington. You see this roll call of crimes that are either very trivial. I mean, it's not trivial for the cattle or the sheep, but
Or the bloke who died, but yeah.
yeah, sheep theft, where it's something that shouldn't really have been a death penalty. Then ones that are very, for the mind of the time, justified, like murder, assaults, and other terrible things that are happening. And there's others. I'm just looking through the kind of the list of names, but certainly within kind of the 19th century, that's where the majority of that 71 deaths have occurred.
God.
There's stabbing and things like that. It seems that really by the Victorian period, it was getting that reputation for being a place where if you committed a crime, you would be put to death for. After the kind of death wasn't made illegal. What am I talking about? Death was illegal. You cannot die. No.
Cannot die, okay? Yeah.
After a public execution was made illegal, they constructed an execution shed, which was an alcove at the back wall of the prison.
Oh,
And
that
then
was nice.
the, yeah, thanks for that. They were kind of, and the deaths were kind of alternated between the execution shed and the building that had been the person, the governor's house.
The admin choice.
It's rather interestingly, if you skip to kind of the 20th century, which is a little bit of a skip, but if we just go through the
No, I moved around, honestly. Which, yeah, don't worry. I think I'll get used to it.
We go through the 1900s ones. It is literally just he was killed and then he was killed. But all 8 cases of men who were put to death in the 20th century were involving a murder of a woman. So we've
That's
got far less actual people condemned to death, but all 8 cases involved the murder of a woman. So the first man to be hanged in the 20th century was a man called Richard Wigley.
That name lulled into Wigley? False security, I'm just going to say.
Yeah, Wigley, it's going to be Wigley.
Call you. Yeah.
And he had been in a long-term relationship with Mary Bowen. Mm-hmm. She'd worked at a bar called The Lion Inn in Westbury.
Oh, that's near me.
Yeah, and he...
The Lion's still at Westbury. Is it still the same pub? I know it's newer, but I wonder if it's the same side.
In my records, makes it sound like it's not scrawled on the back of a cereal packet, doesn't
this
it?
This is the shop to which is HQ.
No, from my research, it's the same pub. Their relation ended, and he decided to take his work apron, 2 of his butcher's knives, because he'd been working as a butcher, and put her to kill her. And that was in 1902, and he was hanged on the 18th of March in 1902. And rather interestingly, Henry Pierpoint, who I believe was Albert Pierpoint's dad, if I remember rightly, he certainly related to Albert Pierpoint.
He descended from, like, they had, it was like a family thing. Yeah.
He certainly related to Albert, but that was his first number one. Number one, that's the person.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. So Henry Pierpoint's first kind of job where he was the main person doing the hanging was at Shrewsbury Prison. And it was with this case that of poor Mary Bowen being murdered. And
it is his dad. I've just looked him up.
Brilliant.
Dad.
Yeah.
Really interesting. Oh, carry on. Yeah.
It was sufficient. He dropped 4'10" and it proved sufficient to cause a dislocation of the cervical vertebrae, which was what would have killed him. And
instantaneous then, pretty much. Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. And there's others, but all of the ones kind of in the 20th century involve a woman. So William Fiss, he was 57 and he was living with his 80-year-old mother, Catherine Hughes, in Eccleshall, which was then Staffordshire, but it's now Shropshire, or at least part of it Shropshire.
Mm-hmm.
And after being drinking heavily, he ended up killing his mother. It started off as a quarrel. He killed her. He was put to death there. Mm. Originally, slaughter. However, the evidence, kind of constant quarrels and the threats to kill his mother, which, you know, if you're going to kill your mother, don't threaten to kill her all the time because you're probably not going to get manslaughter. Bit of oversight there. He ended up
being
changed and put to death for that. The one that I find very interesting because it's linked to a ghost story in Iron Bridge, actually, is Frank Griffin. Now, Frank Griffin was a murderer who... obviously, because he got put to death for murder. He killed a 74-year-old lady who was the landlady of the Queen's Head Inn in Ketley in Shropshire. Mm-hmm. She was 74 years old. Her name was Jane Edge. And on the 6th of September 1950, Frank Griffin, who was 40 at the time, he came into a pub at lunchtime. He drank pints of beer. He asked for another, but Jane suggested that he'd be better with a cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
She went to the back and make it. And when she wasn't looking, Griffin decided he was going to empty the bill. She caught him in the act, saying that the money wouldn't do you any good, my lad. And he pushed her, causing her to fall and hit her head on a crate.
Mm.
And when her body was discovered, some of Jane's jewellery was missing, including the money as well. So The following day, the police kind of searched the area. They searched the industrial hospital where he was living in Apley, and they searched several rooms, including one that had been occupied by Griffin, and they found a bloodstained shirt and a bag containing coins. But he'd actually run away and he'd gone to stay in the Tontine Hotel in Ironbridge. So, for those of you who know Ironbridge or have got a vague idea of it, it's the pub that's literally opposite the bridge itself.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah, so
God.
that's the Tontine. It's still open to this day. Lovely pub. It's a hotel as well. And Griffin had gone there and he'd stayed in the Tontine, but the owner had read about the murder and he was suspicious of Griffin. So he'd actually called the police. So Griffin was staying in room 5. Basically, he got caught, tried, put to death, and his ghost is supposedly still meant to haunt the room 5. And you're meant to be able to see sometimes something walking past the window because it's a room with a window overlooking the street.
God.
And he said when the police actually found him, he told them that it wasn't worth it, meaning the murder. He didn't get much and she fell down. He also said that he hit her with a pint mug, but then he later withdrawed that. So you've got this kind of terrible crime that would have been quite a shock to the community that has later ensure that there's a ghost story there. Now, I'm not saying there isn't a ghost. But I think with my job and my role as a folklorist and kind of sort of historian, it doesn't matter whether there's a ghost that haunts the
Yeah, I agree.
Tontine. It's the memory of that crime. It's the memory of that man's presence in the building that has meant that the story endures. So I'd heard about this crime and the ghost that haunted and paced between the window, and occasionally you have reports of people's sheets being ripped off or them seeing him in the room. Before I knew what Shrewsbury Prison was, or before I knew really that it was a real thing. So I was very aware of it before I ever knew what it could possibly be. And I think that's certainly, at least in the 20th century, of the eight, that's the most famous of the crimes. But I want to move away briefly from murder.
I think that's a
And
really sad story, but
it
yeah,
is, yeah.
I've never heard
And
it.
I
That's really moving. Yeah, carry
really
on. Sorry.
feel for her and her family, and also the local community, because she was a landlady in the pub for a very long time and she was very well loved. And you can only imagine, because this is pre, for people who don't know, Telford as a town is a relatively new phenomenon. It's a
Oh,
phenomenon of
yeah.
the 60s.
Even our parents really probably kind
Yeah.
of, it's very, very recent as it is
Yeah.
today. Yeah.
And so, like my grandfather, he refused to call it Telford. It was the villages that were in the area that had now make up Telford. So, prior to Telford really being a thing, there wasn't, there was still communities in the wider community. You might see a sense of brotherhood with someone from Dorley if you were from Madeley, that kind of thing. But you were very much, if you were from Madeley, that was where you were from. You weren't from Telford. You weren't from a wider sense of the thing. So, for the community in Ketley to lose their beloved landlady in such a trivial way, it must have been awful. And I think that's probably why the story does still endure. I think, well, certainly that's why the story endures. But I want to just mention some relatively famous names, some of
Yeah.
which are famous just in Shropshire, and some of them are famous on a wider scale that have spent some time in Her Majesty's company in Shrewsbury Prison. So, Jack Mitton, my mad Jack Mitton.
Oh, very famous in Shropshire, like
Love him.
folkloric legend, really. I know he was real, but he's become almost like a Robin Hood, hasn't he? Everyone's obsessed with him
Yes.
in Shropshire,
Yeah.
yeah.
My favourite fact about Jack Mitton was that he used to ignore his children and he'd occasionally pelt them with fruit.
At least it was fruit and not like
Yeah.
stones or something. Didn't he have, and again, you of all people know, he had a certain number of finely costumed cats, which, as you know me, will hugely appeal to me. Amy knows me, has been to my house, so she knows I am cat obsessed. And you know
Yes, he
well that
did.
my cat Misha would love to be a finely costumed cat. So,
Oh, definitely.
oh,
Yeah.
100%. So, finely costumed cats love him even more. That was true then,
He did. Yes, he did. And he also had a bear, a pet bear,
I'm
that
sorry.
he would sometimes ride, and he loved the bear. So he would
Jack had no chill.
Yeah, he'd often let the bear sit by the fire with him, and he'd also let his favorite racehorse sit by the fire with him.
Oh, so hopefully he was animals then.
He was an animal of
Frank.
But the bear unfortunately bit someone. It bit a servant, and they told him he had to put the bear down. And he said, "Why can't I put the servant down?"
But that was my reaction, which I know is awful. You know, the same, like, if, like, I remember just got into jet because my friend, who I won't name her, but her mum had a beagle long, long past. But when she was little, she fell into his bed and the beagle bit her leg or arm, I think. And the mum was like, "Well, you will get into its bed." And I was like, "That would be me." I would be like,
Peak
"I'm sorry."
Jackknife behavior. Yeah. So
The bear made a lot bigger age than the servant did.
I would implore people to look into Jack Mitton.
Oh, yes,
Absolute
seconded.
eccentric. There's a
You
real
could do an
tragic side.
episode on him, actually.
Yeah, I'd love that because I'm obsessed.
Do a special, because I don't know much about him, but you do. Yeah.
His biography was written by his best mate, and it's a kind of 19th century work of art, and the whole book is his best mate going, "Yeah, he did do that, but it's not as bad. Don't listen to the PR. He didn't mean it, or he was having a laugh." But he was kind of a rake. He was said to be kind of Byronish. He the epitome of kind of mad, bad, and dangerous to know.
Oh, this sort of Byronic. Yeah, okay.
Yes, and he spent all of his money very, very quickly. When he was tried to be put on a budget by someone who was handling him at the time, he said, "Well, he'd rather die than live on a budget."
Oscar
so,
Wilde. Yeah.
Yeah, he ended up in a debtor's prison, and he spent some time in Shrewsbury Prison before being transferred to the King's Bench Prison, and that was in 1834, which wasn't
Did
really long.
he?
Yeah. So he was in there not long before he passed away, really.
Because the King's Bench, that closed in 1880, but that's Southwark, like that was next to the Marshalsea, like the most
Yeah.
famous debtors' prison of all. So Jack, I did not know that, because if you love debtors' prison, which I'm a prison geek, the King's Bench prison is a very famous debtors' prison. So history fans will find that even more interesting. Bloody hell, I didn't
So
know that.
Jack, yeah, Mad Jack. And then there's two other people I want to just briefly mention. So Robert Welch was one of the members of the Great Train Robbery Gang. 1964, he was in Shrewsbury Prison. He was later transferred to other prisons, and he kind of spent time everywhere, but he had been in Shrewsbury Prison. So that's really interesting, having that kind of nationally significant crime, him spending time in the building. And then this is probably my favourite Shrewsbury prison fact. Ricky Tomlinson
Yeah,
from
legend.
my family, he actually spent some time in Shrewsbury Prison in Her Majesty's service. So he spent 2 years in Shrewsbury for conspiracy to intimidate, for his involvement in miners at steelworkers and builders strike in
Oh
1933.
my God.
Yeah, so he was verily, what am I talking about? He was very heavily involved in the strike and kind of workers' disputes in not just in Shropshire, kind of in his native Liverpool. But in 1972, he joined the floor pickets in the builders' workers' dispute in Shrewsbury. But then there was allegations of violence during the protest. So in 1973, he was charged with conspiracy to commit and intimidate. And he was one of the Shrewsbury Two. I've got a book about the Shrewsbury Two I'll lend you.
Yeah, do, because that's
And
really interesting. I never knew why he was there or how long. It's really interesting.
So he was pleaded innocent at Shrewsbury Crown Court, and he was guilty and sentenced to 2 years in prison alongside a fellow picketer, Des Warren. He was released in 1975, and he kind of disputed his sentence all the way through. He was very, very involved in kind of that industrial workers' strikes. Fascinating, absolutely fascinated by the workers' strikes in 70s, 80s, and 1926 going and previously. He's a close friend of Arthur Skarsgård still, and he
What?
spent a lot of time campaigning for kind of basic rights for people, and rights for workers as well. And he spent time in Shrewsbury Prison for it, but I just think it's fascinating that these populist movements, these strikes that kind of were up and down the country. Shropshire didn't really have a miners' strike in the same time as the famous miners' strikes
In
happened
the north,
because,
yeah.
of our mines had closed down by about 65. But the build it was builders in Telford, it was builders in Shropshire, and being a very famous face for people of about our age and slightly older. So yeah, so I want to just finish talking about Shrewsbury Prison by mentioning a quote from "On Moonlit Heath and Lonesome Bank" by A. Houseman from the eponymous Shropshire Lad. It says, "They hang us in Shrewsbury jail, the whistles blow forlorn, and the trains all night groan on the rail to the men that die on the morn." And I think it perfectly sums up that quote.
Yeah, it's
The
haunting.
I it is, isn't it? And it's the idea that you've got executions happening down the road from the train station, and that those men conceivably would have heard the trains, heard the movement of people. Reminds me of the Johnny Cash song, "I hear the train are coming."
Oh yeah, also Prison Blues, yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't going to sing it. I'm not going to
Oh, I love that
embarrass
song.
myself, but it's a great one. And it's just the idea you can have this juxtaposition between life and death happening in two very different buildings. So trust Houseman to bring it.
Is it Plymouth Prison? Oh, what was Kingston? Wasn't it? I always think of that because I think of the chap who ran the Tower of London. But Kingston Prison is now flats. Or what, certainly part of it is a flat, and I think they're converting the rest. Holloway is going to be, in inverted commas, affordable housing. Well, let's see what the property developer considers affordable
Yeah.
housing. But you look at like the fact that there was 300 suffragettes incarcerated at Holloway Prison in the early 20th century. It was built in 1852. Both you and I still remember Holloway being a prison. And I know there's younger people that no, I'd have thought most people now of kind of like teenage and over would possibly know about Holloway or remember it being still a prison. In fact, when you say Holloway Prison, people still think it's going, don't they? It's still, that's one
Yeah,
that has
yeah.
stayed in the psyche, perhaps because it was the most famous female prison. But in fact, interestingly enough, it wasn't female only until 1903, which I always find really,
Really,
really
yeah.
interesting. Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. And when you look at this idea of the suffragettes, and I'm only going to talk about that briefly, but I just think it's kind of, this is one of those things when we think about suffragettes, you think about Emmeline Pankhurst and these amazing women and what they did. And in fact, like the WI, big shout out to the WI because they supported votes for women. You, or not all of us, but some of us are guilty of forgetting exactly what they did. So by, giving us the vote, because there was one that I wrote down, I thought this was really interesting. And she described the fact because they were force-fed. And Emmeline Pankhurst wrote, "My gums, when they prized them open, were always sore and bleeding, with bits of loose and jagged flesh. Sometimes the tube was coughed up two or three times before they finally got it down. Sometimes, but not usually, as I was generally too much agitated by then, I felt the tube go right down into the stomach, a sickening, terrifying sensation, especially when it reached the breast." And that gave way eventually to the Cat and Mouse Act, which what came in 1913, which the government introduced, and it became known as the Cat and Mouse Act, which permitted hunger-striking women to be released into the community for them to be rearrested when they'd regained health. And there is a very famous, when you think about Uncle Sam and all these posters, like propaganda, they're famous, but there's a very famous poster, usually in a sort of sage, olivey green, and it's depicting a cat biting into a suffragette who's draped with the famous sash hanging out of its mouth. And it says, "The Liberal cat, electors vote against him. Keep the Liberal out." There were also women, so th that generally it was, we were talking about the class divide, but Constance Lytton, who was the daughter of Lord Lytton, was jailed in 1909. She was twice jailed. And she was protesting in the House of Commons and claimed to have received worse treatment when she disguised herself as a working class seamstress rather than revealing her aristocratic status. And she was also known for her attempt to mutilate her body. So such was, I suppose, her determination. But I imagine that I think there's a bit more than that going on to be able to do this to yourself. Not nice. But she said, "I had decided to write the words 'Votes for Women' on my body, scratching it on my skin with a needle, beginning over the heart and ending on my face. I proposed to show the first half of the inscription to doctors, telling them that as I knew how much appearance is respected by officials, I thought it well to warn that the last letter, and upon a full stop, would come upon my cheek and be quite fresh and visible on the day of my release." So I mean, such was the treatment, and also the suppression and things like this. It's not something, even today with the pay divide and all these things that's still against us, that we can probably quite imagine to the degree that they had it. But, you know, it's the same as, you know, as suffragettes that were killed or beaten, all these things. The measures that they went to were often overlooked, and these women went to prison and were held in prison and were force fed, and so they do play a role and largely unmentioned in terms of prison history. And I think if you were looking at prison history, one woman who is constantly mentioned, and I find her nuance, is Ruth Ellis, who was a perpetrator of a heinous crime but was also a victim of severe domestic abuse. And Ruth Ellis was the last woman in England, of course, to be hanged by Albert Pierpoint in 1955. And this is depicted in the film by Albert Pierpoint, who is, of course, played by Timothy Spall, because he always plays people like that. And he's a very good actor. But I mean, if ever there was casting like that, you can just imagine him looking, going, yeah, I'll play him.
Yeah, give it to me.
Yeah. Timothy's like, I'm here. Don't worry. Look no further. But you know, she was a nuanced person. It was interesting because then, just as now, she has been defined by her youth, her blonde hair, the fact she was attractive, the fact that she was an escort, all these sexualized things. Without, you know, we do look at the abuse, but it's interesting how women either are displayed as kind of suffragettes, things like this, and of course, which one of the Mitfords went to Holloway as well, and they're either a kind of troublesome aristocrat, a sexual woman in her youth, or a suffragette, you know. And these are the way they're portrayed, not me saying that, you know. And it's interesting, and you don't generally get women in situations like this being folkloric heroes in the way that we for the men, they're portrayed quite differently. But, you know, and I'm not excusing Ruth Ellis committed a heinous crime. She did. And yeah, I think she should have gone to prison for what she did. But I also think that she was treated very, very cruelly. She was beaten to the point that she miscarried. There was various things, you know, horrendous. And so whether, I mean, maybe she should have had actually probably gone to somewhere that could have helped her, you know, a hospital or something like that. But maybe saying going to prison was a bit hasty. But I think there should have been something to, you know, in place as a punishment, but also to help her. Should she have hanged? No, but then I don't think people should be hanged in general. But she has become folkloric for the wrong reasons, and she becomes sexualized. And it's interesting because actually people like that are eclipsed by the fame of somebody like Albert Pierpoint, where actually, yes, he was doing his job, I suppose, and you look at that, but he retired and ran a pub, and people always asked him, and he would never say how many people he executed, and they think it's somewhere between, rather vaguely, 400 and something to 600, though people don't know, in 25 years of being the official hangman. So it's interesting, again, how he is kind of immortalized again in a different way. And wasn't he also Timothy Evans? Because that was the chap with the, what's the name? The murders, Christie, John Christie. Murdered in London. So there's other cases where he was famously the executioner. But, you know, it's fascinating. We think of prisons, we look at these buildings, we think about the Illustrated Police News and all these sort of things, and the sensations, the shock, the scandals that we still read about today. If we still read that, you know, Mountjoy Prison, somebody died because they were held in a cell with other prisoners, you know, before they knew where to put them. And the guy was beaten to death, you know, and not long ago. And we read about this in the news and we're shocked and we're horrified, and it makes its way onto a podcast about Mountjoy and things like this. But, you know, these things are no different. So when they did things like transportation was abolished in 1868, it had been declining since the 1840s. You had the Marshalsea, one of the most famous deprived prisons, closed in 1842, and the Fleet as well. Pentonville Prison opened in the same year. So there's the irony. You know, you close one prison to then open another in a different way. The Pentonville is still a very rundown, unpleasant prison. Debtors' prisons, really, by 1869, the Debtors Act came in that closed those prisons, and it was about 1862, I think, where one of the last ones closed. And in fact, actually still standing is there's a prison in York, which I believe is obviously no longer operating as a debtor's prison, but is the last standing sort of purpose-built debtor's prison that you can go and visit. But, you know, you look at, so like transportation, when you think about like the phrase POMS, when they, you know, they call us POMS, but POMS is nothing to the pomegranates, as people often erroneously say it's prisoners of Her Majesty, or as was the phrase. But, you know, transportation changed, and they were sent to the colonies, and that did change with the American Civil War, was one of the reasons largely that stopped. But what happened, interesting, and I should sort of whiz through this before we close because I'm aware it's a long episode, but was the kind of the brutal, barbaric past of prison hulks, which were known as Wicked Noah's Arks, which is sort of glorious but hideous. But it's, you know, it's a fantastic name. It does what it says on the tin, but it is also quite really rather morbid. But Henry Mayhew, again, wrote about this in 1855. He went to visit one on the Thames. And that's the bit that people don't always understand quite, is that these were docked into places like the Thames. And of course, famously, in Great Expectations there, they talk about Magwitch being on these hulks. And you could see them. People could see them from the land, these great big ships. And they were retired ships that people were living, let's say living on, were prisoners on. And if they couldn't go off and work in the day, which a lot of the, you know, those that capable would have done, they stayed on looking after the sick or basically stayed on all day. Quite often the people in charge of the hulks would get off at night because they were so bad. They were like, oh, I'm not staying on here to get shit kicked out of me. Generally, some of them had space for about 240 men sleeping in, frankly, rather rank hammocks. And I'm kind of whizzing through this, but actually I should have probably mentioned these at the start because they are interesting and awful. They had for decades protested these prison reformers. They were something that had been described as rotten, leaky tubs. They were long hated. And some figures for you. The highest total of inmates in prison hulks in 1842, which again is the year Pentonville Prison opened, the Fleet closed, and the Marshalsea closed. 1842 was a big year for prisons. 4,280. And 3,615 were transported to what is now Tanzania. Tasmania. Why can't I speak? It's catching. Tasmania. And these, as I say, so one in four, the fatality rate which is a lot. August 1776 to March 1778, a total of 632 convicts held, 167 died. There was a very famous one held at Woolwich, and that went on for quite a long time. And they had a prison where they had 216 men, and they were who were granted pardon out of a total of 819. And this was only ever supposed to be a sort of temporary measure in reaction to the American Revolutionary War. And they did, you know, when they were transporting women, children, things like this. And of course, famously, Uriah Heep in David Copperfield. You know, when your mind just goes black, we've talked about so much stuff. They do mention and the hulks as well. But what's so interesting about these is in the 1700s, they were sort of prolific. And there were about 25 hulks on the Thames estuary at Woolwich, Deptford, Chatham. People were just held on these often indefinitely. One thing I did think was interesting was a source that said in 1776, one day's rations to be shared by a mess of six convicts comprised of, brace yourself, £5 of dry ship's biscuits, which are not like charming little shoji biscuits, not great, half an ox cheek and 3 pints of split pea soup. And they drank weak beer and water filtered from the river. How they filtered it, oof, God knows, but I hope you enjoy dysentery and or cholera. So this went on, and really kind of going into the 1800s, then this had sort of started to have, you know, its decline. But they were, although a relatively brief history, it wasn't until the 1820s that boys were moved to separate ships. They were held there with men, so God only knows. You dread to think what went on, but the violence and the depravity at these places was well documented, and people were absolutely terrified of them. And there were stories of abandoned ships and horror stories about people kind of escaping, getting shot, getting beaten. Really just not great. And you had people that kind of were described in sort of suspicious clothes, where they would wear kind of, you know, a change of clothes, but they would have you know, something on them that kind of marked them, like, you know, ran their ankles or something, you know, where you clearly they'd been tethered. So, you know, these people were desperate. They were desperate to escape and often sort of resorted to quite extreme violence to escape. And in 1855, with Mayhew's visit, really, by 1857, the Hawke system had come to an end, those last 2 years. But the Defence was burnt down, which is a very famous ship held at Woolwich. But a lot of these places, they'd replaced the kind of the colonies, but in a relatively short time frame, it was still longer than it should have been, and they often get overlooked or are slightly romanticized, these great big gothic eerie ships. But I mean, they were some of the most deprived, violent, unsafe, unsanitary, brutal, cruel places, without doubt. And they were sort of, I suppose, in a way, almost like the, could you say they're worse than debtors' prisons? Not different, but just that they were on the water, and I think that was it. So I'm not going to go any more than that because it's a long episode and I've gone on for ages. But I think, you know, there's so many sources, so many places that you can read and learn much, much more. And so much so that I'm now mispronouncing stuff because I've talked for so long. But I think this idea of starting with a question of, you know, the difference between a jail and a prison, and whether jail is somewhere you held before punishment or are you held there for the punishment? I don't think we had the answer then. I don't think we have the answer now. Is there anything you want to add?
No, I think it's just, I think you've pretty much summed it up there, is that the purpose of this episode wasn't to necessarily find answers, but to explore the possibilities. And I think also to emphasise that these buildings are part of our history, they're part of our collective history, and that, you know, is it good that they're being turned into apartment buildings and things like that? Probably because they're enduring, but also we must, as they change and they decline and they become something else, we must remember what they have been, and what they symbolize to the people of the time. And I think certainly we scratched the surface tonight. We've talked for so long, we've got, you know, really uncovered a lot, but we've only just scratched the surface of the stories within these buildings. So if there's been anything that has interested you or that has kind of ignited that spark, I would implore you to look deeper and find the narratives and the stories from your own communities, or if you're in Shropshire from this community, you know, and dig a little bit deeper, because you won't be disappointed.
Yeah, no, I think you articulated that perfectly. And I think that's the natural close, as I say, because in no small part because I can no longer even say words properly. But thank you so much to everybody. And if you've got all the way to the end, or maybe you've listened to it in a couple of sessions, then fantastic. We hope you enjoy it. It's been you know, certainly a really interesting episode to research and talk about.
Definitely.
See you very, very soon. Thank you so much. Bye bye bye.
Bye bye.